Third element of shame resilience is reaching out. One of the most important benefits of reaching out to others is learning that the experiences that make us feel the most alone are actually universal. Regardless of who we are, how we were raised, or what we believe, all of us fight hidden, silent battles against not being good enough and not belonging enough. When we find the courage to share our experiences and the compassion to hear others tell their stories, we force shame out of hiding and end the silence. When we don't reach out, we often end up in fear, blame, and disconnection. The fourth and last element of shame resilience is speaking shame. Shame derives its power from being unspeakable. That's why it loves perfectionists. It's so easy to keep us quiet. If we cultivate enough awareness about shame to name it and speak it, we've basically cut it off at the knees. Shame hates having words wrapped around it. If we speak shame, it begins to wither. Language and story bring light to shame and destroy it. When we don't talk about how we feel and ask for what we need, we often shut down, act out, or do both. Learning to speak shame also allows you to pick up on some of the subtle and even gaslighting language of shame. This is language that is used to shame and to defend shaming when we're trying to explain how we feel and what we need. I'm now very cautious when I hear things like, "You're so sensitive." "Oh, I didn't realize you're so fragile." "I didn't realize this was such an issue for you." "Man, you're so defensive." "I guess I'll have to watch what I say around you." "You know, that's all in your head." Or, "You seem really hostile." And I've totally banned words like loser, lame, and weak. I'm also not a fan of anything that's brutal, including honesty. Honesty is the best policy. But honesty that's motivated by shame, anger, fear, or hurt is not honesty. It's shame, anger, fear, or hurt disguised as honesty. Just because something is accurate or factual doesn't mean it can't be used in a destructive manner. An example of this is when someone says something really hurtful and then, "Oh, sorry, I'm just telling you the truth. These are just the facts." The big takeaway from this section is that empathy is at the heart of connection. It's the circuit board for leaning into the feelings of others, reflecting back a shared experience of the world, and reminding them that they're not alone. To be able to stand in discomfort with people who are processing shame or hurt or disappointment or hardship, and to be able to say to them, "I see you, and I can hold space for this," is the epitome of courage. The best part is that empathy is not hardwired into our genetic code. We can learn it. And we need to, because as the poet June Jordan wrote, "We are the ones we've been waiting for." Section 5. Curiosity and grounded confidence. Grounded confidence is the messy process of learning and unlearning, practicing and failing, and surviving a few misses. This brand of confidence is not blustery arrogance or posturing or built on bullshit. It's real, solid, and built on self-awareness and practice. Once we witness how courage can transform the way we lead, we can trade the heavy, suffocating armor that keeps us small for grounded confidence that lifts us up and supports our efforts to be brave. It's unreasonable to believe that we can just rip off our self-protection mechanisms and streak through the office. Most of us armor up early in our lives because as children, we needed to. In some instances, the armor protected us from being hurt or disappointed, from feeling invisible or unlovable. In some situations, we had to self-protect to stay physically or emotionally safe. Vulnerability is the greatest casualty of trauma. When we're raised in unsafe environments, confronted with racism, violence, poverty, sexism, homophobia, and even pervasive shaming, vulnerability can be life-threatening, and armor is safety. And when we think about how millennials and Gen Zers were raised, many of their parents swaddled them in armor out of their own lack of confidence as parents and people. The more grounded confidence parents have, the more likely they are to prepare their child for the path by teaching courage, praising effort, and modeling grit, versus trying to prepare a perfect path for their child by fixing, praising only results, and intervening all the time. We've spent a disproportionately large amount of time unrumbling with vulnerability for a simple reason. It's the fundamental skill of courage building. Building the grounded confidence to rumble with vulnerability and discomfort, rather than armoring up, running away, shutting down, or tapping out, completely prepares you for living into your values, building trust, and learning to rise. The next three parts of this book. Understanding rumbling with vulnerability as the fundamental skill of daring leadership is absolutely essential. Skill building in sports provides a really great analogy for this. So all sports rely on key fundamentals, those skills that are drilled into players from the first day you sign up for a class or join a team. When I reflect on my experiences playing tennis and swimming, I remember always thinking, God, let's race. I'm tired of doing 50 flip turns in a row. Or I don't want to sashay across this dang tennis court holding my racket in volley position one more time. Let's play. But developing fundamental skills through disciplined practice is what gives players the grounded confidence to dare greatly. The same is true for leaders. Developing a disciplined practice of rumbling with vulnerability gives leaders the strength and emotional stamina to dare greatly. In sports, when you're in the heat of play and under pressure, you have to be able to rely on the skills you've built to be able to execute, deliver, and perform. If you've flip-turned and sashayed enough times, the mechanics of those moves enter muscle memory. Having the grounded confidence to rely on the skills we've developed over time allows us to focus on higher-order objectives, challenges, and goals. My pool playing efforts are a good example of this. I always thought playing pool looked pretty easy and attributed my poor performance in college to trying to juggle a beer in one hand and a cigarette in the other while lining up a shot. But Chaz, whom you've met earlier, plays competitively and has disabused me of the notion that it was the partying that got in the way of me running the table. It turns out that I suck at pool because I've only done it a handful of times, and the players who make it look easy are deeply skilled in the fundamentals of billiards. When pool players design their shots, they always consider three elements: angles, speed, and spin. The success of executing their design shot is dependent on the fundamental skill of being able to reliably and consistently deliver the cue stick to the spot on the cue ball that sets the shot in motion. That means good pool players spend hundreds of hours building that foundational skill of consistent cue delivery, not to mention the equally tedious work of building a steady bridge, mastering a pendulum arm stroke, and developing a stable stance. One fundamental exercise that's commonly practiced is the empty bottle drill. Players set an empty glass soda bottle on its side and practice stroking their cue stick into the neck of the bottle without moving the bottle. There's very little margin for error. Of course, you never see a glass bottle on a pool table during a tournament, but you can bet that the best players have spent hours practicing their strokes, their breaks, and their shots. When the pressure is on, they've built the necessary strength and stamina to make it through 10 hours of play, and they're confident enough in their fundamentals to focus on strategy and shot selection. Lauren, our director of facilitator community engagement and research, is an ex-professional soccer player from Scotland and a former graduate student of mine. She explained that the fundamental skill in soccer is ball control. She told me that from the time she was little, coaches would run drills that had players touching the ball a million times with different parts of the foot. Even as a professional athlete, she spent countless hours passing the ball with a partner using different parts of her foot. She told me, "We had a 4-foot brick wall that went around the perimeter of our garden at our house in Scotland. I would stand in front of one section of the wall and I would pick a brick and try to hit it with the ball. I would do this for hours, picking another brick, then another. The entire time I was just working on my ball control." As in Chaz's story about solid fundamentals allowing you to focus on higher order challenges, Lauren said you have to master the fundamentals of ball control so you can pick your head up in a game and see what's going on around you. You have to read the field and strategize your next move before you even have possession of the ball. You have to have complete confidence about your mastery of that skill so you can focus on other things. In tough conversations, hard meetings, and emotionally charged decision-making, leaders need the grounded confidence to stay tethered to their values, respond rather than react emotionally, and operate from self-awareness, not self-protection. Having the rumbling skills to hold the tension and discomfort allows us to give care and attention to others, stay open, and curious and meet the challenges. Earlier this year, I had the opportunity to work with Nutanix, an enterprise cloud software company in Silicon Valley. In my conversations with their founder, chairman, and CEO, Dheeraj Pandey, I was struck not only by his belief in the importance of vulnerability in leadership, but the why behind that belief. Dheeraj explained to me that when leaders don't have the skills to lean into vulnerability, they're not able to successfully hold the tension of the paradoxes that are inherent in entrepreneurship. His examples of the paradoxes that elicit vulnerability in leaders align with what we heard from research participants. The paradoxes include optimism and paranoia, letting chaos reign, which is the act of building, and reigning in chaos, the act of scaling, big heart and tough decision making, humility and fierce resolve, velocity and quality when building new things, left brain and right brain, simplicity and choice, thinking global, acting local, ambition and attention to detail, thinking big, but starting small, short-term and long-term, marathons and sprints, or marathon of sprints in business building. Dheeraj told me leaders must learn the skills to hold these tensions and get adept at balancing on the tightrope of life. Ultimately, leadership is the ability to thrive in the ambiguity of paradoxes and opposites. Building rumbling skills is not easy, but easy is overrated. An increasing number of studies are confirming what most of us have always known but hated. Easy learning doesn't build strong skills. In an article in Fast Company magazine, Mary Slaughter and David Rock with the NeuroLeadership Institute write, "Unfortunately, the trend in many organizations is to design learning to be as easy as possible. Aiming to respect their employees' busy lives, companies build training programs that can be done at any time with no prerequisites and often on a mobile device. The result is fun and easy training programs that employees rave about, which makes them easier for developers to sell, but don't actually instill lasting learning. Worse still, programs like these may lead employers to optimize for misleading metrics like maximizing for likes or shares or high net promoter scores, which are easy to earn when programs are fun and fluent, but not when they're demanding. Instead of designing for recall or behavior change, we risk designing for popularity. The reality is that to be effective, learning needs to be effortful. That's not to say that anything that makes learning easier is counterproductive or that all unpleasant learning is effective. The key here is desirable difficulty. The same way you feel a muscle burn when it's being strengthened, the brain needs to feel some discomfort when it's learning. Your mind might hurt for a while, but that's a good thing. Learning how to rumble with vulnerability is work, and vulnerability never becomes comfortable. But practicing means that when vulnerability is washing over us, we can hear grounded confidence whisper in our ear, "This is hard and awkward and uncomfortable. You may not know how it's going to turn out, but you are strong and you've practiced what it takes to create and hold space for this." I like the equation that grounded confidence equals rumble skills plus curiosity plus practice. We've covered a lot of new language, skills, and tools, and as you can probably tell, they all share the same DNA, curiosity. Curiosity is an act of vulnerability and courage. Researchers are finding evidence that curiosity is correlated with creativity, intelligence, improved learning and memory, and problem solving. A study published in the October 22, 2014 issue of the journal Neuron suggests that the brain's chemistry changes when we become curious, helping us better learn and retain information. But curiosity is uncomfortable because it involves uncertainty and vulnerability. In his book, Curious, The Desire to Know and Why Your Future Depends on It, Ian Leslie writes, "Curiosity is unruly. It doesn't like rules, or at least it assumes that all rules are provisional, subject to the laceration of a smart question nobody has yet thought to ask. It disdains the approved pathways, preferring diversions, unplanned excursions, impulsive left turns. In short, curiosity is deviant. I think this is exactly why curiosity leads to grounded confidence and rumble skills. We're scared to have hard conversations because we can't control the path or outcome, and we start coming out of our skin when we don't get to resolution fast enough. It's as if we'd rather have a bad solution that leads to action than stay in the uncertainty of problem identification. Einstein is one of our best curiosity and confidence mentors. I love two of his sayings. The first, if I had an hour to solve a problem, I'd spend 55 minutes thinking about the problem and 5 minutes thinking about solutions. He also reportedly said, it's not that I'm so smart. It's just that I stay with problems longer. The knower in us, our ego, either races to beat everyone in the room with an answer that may or may not address the real issues, or thinks, I don't want to talk about this because I'm not sure how it's going to go or how people are going to react. I might not say the right thing or have the right answers. Curiosity says, no worries. I love a wild ride. I'm up for wherever this goes. And I'm in for however long it takes to get to the heart of the problem. I don't have to know the answers or say the right thing. I just have to keep listening and keep questioning. Here are some specific rumble starters and questions that we use. Number one, the story I make up. This is by far one of the most powerful rumble tools in the free world. It's changed every facet of my life, and we'll walk through it in the part Learning to Rise. Number two, I'm curious about. Number three, tell me more. Number four, that's not my experience. Instead of, you're wrong about him or her or this or it. For example, if someone says, John is so difficult to work with. Rather than saying, no, he's not, it's so much more productive to say, that's not my experience of him. I'm wondering. Number six, help me understand. Number seven, walk me through. Number eight, you know what? We're both dug in right now. Tell me about your passion around this topic. Number nine, tell me why this doesn't fit or work for you. Number 10, I'm working from these assumptions. What about you? Number 11, what problem are we actually trying to solve? Sometimes we'll be an hour into a difficult rumble when someone will bravely say, wait, I'm confused. What problem are we trying to solve? 90% of the time, we'll realize that we're not on the same page because we skipped the problem identification process and set a meeting intention of finding the solution to a problem we've yet to define. Sometimes the best rumbles start with a 30-minute fact-finding conversation and an agreement to circle back in a few hours or the next day, but don't wait too long. I recently had a conversation with two colleagues about a training that we're planning. As soon as we sat down and they presented the plan, I knew it was going to get hard. We were on totally different pages. I simply said, we're in very different places. Why don't we spend 20 minutes rumbling on how we got here, then circle back tomorrow and land on the approach? Walk me through all the assumptions you're working off. How did you come up with the schedule? What are y'all seeing as the goal of the training? Help me understand what you see as the benefit of this approach. It only took 10 minutes before we realized that we were working toward different goals, we had different priorities, and we were working off different data. My colleague said, wow, this is really helpful. Let's come back with some of the information we're both missing and get on the same page about the goals and priorities tomorrow. Great. Another helpful curiosity tool is staying on the lookout for horizon conflict. Our role dictates where we should set our lens in terms of the organizational horizon. As a founder and CEO, I'm expected to plot a long-term course for the company. I try to bounce back and forth from a 10-year horizon to the current state of affairs. Other leaders on my team have responsibility for different horizons. An operations leader may be focused on a 6-month horizon because of a huge launch schedule. To lead effectively, we're responsible for respecting and leveraging the different views and staying curious about how they can often conflict. When rumbles start to get tough, we know to check in on horizon issues. And while we may all have different perspectives and may not share the same level of knowledge about every detail of the organization, we must have a shared reality of the current state of the organization. Horizon conflict doesn't give us permission to lose focus on the organization as a whole. I can't be so concerned with the 5-year goal that I don't know about a culture issue that we need to address right away. Driving greatness from curiosity and learning. When I was researching and writing Rising Strong, I learned that the most common barrier to getting curious is having a dry well. In his 1994 article, The Psychology of Curiosity, George Lowenstein introduced this information gap perspective on curiosity. Lowenstein, a professor of economics and psychology at Carnegie Mellon University, proposed that curiosity is the feeling of deprivation we experience when we identify and focus on a gap in our knowledge. What's important about this perspective is that it means we have to have some level of knowledge or awareness before we can get curious. We aren't curious about something we're unaware of or know nothing about. Lowenstein explains that simply encouraging people to ask questions doesn't go very far towards stimulating curiosity. He writes, "To induce curiosity about a particular topic, it may be necessary to prime the pump, to use intriguing information to get folks interested so they become more curious." Here's the good news. If you've listened up to this point in the book, you're primed and ready to go. We may not know enough or have enough practice nailing every rumble, but we know enough to get curious. And there's even more good news. A growing number of researchers believe that curiosity and knowledge building grow together. The more we know, the more we want to know. I want to share two case examples with you that demonstrate how the combination of rumbling skills and the grounded confidence to take off the armor and get curious can transform an organization. The first is from Stefan Larsson, and the second is from Dr. Sine Bell. Stefan Larsson is a seasoned retail leader who was most recently chief executive officer of the Ralph Lauren Corporation. He is credited with turning around the iconic American apparel brand, Old Navy, where he and his team delivered 12 straight quarters of growth and added $1 billion in sales in 3 years. He also spent 14 years as a key part of the leadership team that built the Swedish-based fashion giant, H&M, into one of the three most valued fashion brands in the world, with global operations in 44 countries and sales that grew from $3 billion to $17 billion. As you hear this case study, you'll see the role vulnerability plays as the foundation for the next three skill sets: living into our values, braving trust, and learning to rise. Stefan writes, "When I took the helm of Old Navy, the brand had faltered for a number of years, and we had to find our way back to the original vision. After a few days in the archives, we uncovered the original vision statement, which was about making aspirational American style accessible to every family. Now, we just had to deliver on it. The most crucial component to unlock and the biggest driver of success turned out to be transforming the organizational culture. What was once an entrepreneurial, fast-moving, and empowering culture had, over the course of several years of struggling performance, become hierarchical, siloed, political, and filled with fear. Most team members understood our collective challenges. They saw clearly what we needed to do and what stood in the way. However, very few dared to share their insights or voice their concerns in larger settings or take action on them, because of the fear of looking bad or making someone else look bad. To turn the brand around, our main job was to build a culture of trust. To do this, we set out with a few goals that turned out to be the key drivers of our success. First, we started with weekly learning sessions for our top 60 leaders, 2 hours every week together as one team, with the premise that we would no longer judge outcomes as good or bad. We would just read the outcomes as outcomes, learn from them, and quickly improve. The goal was to outlearn our competitors. We would stop the shaming and blaming and the judging of outcomes as good or bad, and instead continuously ask ourselves, what did we set out to do? What happened? What did we learn? And how fast can we improve on it? The second, we launched quarterly town halls and company-wide calls where we, in connection to our vision and the plan we had set out, shared the outcomes, learnings, and improvements on a regular basis. Last, as a management team, we physically moved in together into one big room with glass walls where we intentionally unlocked the doors in the middle of our headquarters to further enable openness, trust, and teamwork by using the space to visually mirror our approach and attitude. We also encouraged all team members, regardless of their position in the organization, to come by and reach out with ideas and thoughts around anything that could improve what we were doing or not doing. It didn't take long until everyone started to come up with more and more ideas of how to improve the business. At first, people were hesitant to believe that we were really serious about the no shaming and blaming. But over time, they started to speak up in meetings, whether it was asking a question without knowing the answer, or sharing the outcomes from an initiative that had underdelivered, formerly talked about as failures, now reframed as learnings. We all started to show more vulnerability in front of each other. We started to trust each other more since we were all in it together. As a management team, we focused on asking questions, experimenting, and driving continuous improvement until we started to get traction. Instead of thinking about outcomes as good and bad, we set up failure-proof ways of working. This allowed us to overcome setbacks and put the focus on learning instead of blaming. Once we removed the fear of failure and the fear of being judged, we started to outlearn and outperform our best competitors. As a result, we delivered 12 consecutive quarters of growth in a very challenging market and added $1 billion in sales in 3 years. But what I'm most proud of as a leader was being able to empower my team to take vulnerability and make it into a strength, to foster a culture of trust, openness, and collaboration, and to shift our mentality to one of continuous learning. Today, over 2 years after I've moved on to lead another company, I still get emails from team members who want to share what they've learned and how they continue to drive greatness from their learnings. Those emails make all the difference. I love the idea of driving greatness from our learnings. I've seen it work in organizations across the globe where people are willing to be vulnerable. Another great example is this next case study from Dr. Sinead Bell. She is the principal of Morton Ranch Junior High in Katy, Texas. She has served as an administrator since 2005 at both the elementary and secondary levels. She taught middle school and high school English and also coached girls basketball. Sinead was named the 2015 Katy ISD Elementary Principal of the Year. She writes, "Leading others is hard. Being the leader of adults, children, and a school community is even harder. The role of a principal is complex, challenging, rewarding, and lonely all at the same time. When I began my daring leadership journey, I was a successful school leader. During my second principalship, I did a deep dive into this daring leadership work and realized that I had only scratched the surface of what it means to dare to lead. This personal and professional journey has changed my practice as a leader in 3 specific ways, teaching me how to practice vulnerability, increasing my self-awareness, and giving me the tools to have tough conversations. Today, these 3 areas of focus are foundational components of my leadership approach." Practicing vulnerability. There's an old saying that I lead by now. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. I've learned one way to help people understand how much you care is to share your story. Practicing vulnerability has given me the courage to share my personal story of growing up in situational poverty and a broken home with my staff. When they hear about my journey to overcome huge obstacles, they better understand my commitment to building a supportive school environment. As a leader, I no longer check my personal life at the door. In fact, sharing stories and leading through the lens of multiple perspectives and experiences has made me more approachable and relatable to my students, staff, and community. By sharing my story and my why for leading, I help my staff understand my purpose, passion, and commitment to courage. It also gave others permission to practice vulnerability and to be brave in sharing and owning their life journey. Becoming self-aware. When I lack self-awareness as a leader, and when I'm not connected with the intentions driving my thoughts, feelings, and actions, I limit the perspective and insights that I can share with the people I lead. Today, through journaling and seeking feedback from others, I've been able to grow and refine my leadership skills in a way that is more responsive to the needs of my staff, students, and community. Spending time in quiet reflection has become part of my weekly practice. Engaging in tough conversations. Doing this work made me realize that there is no way to address the academic disparities between the different student groups without leaning into tough conversations on an ongoing basis. I knew there was a critical and urgent need to move past the "this is the way we've always done it" attitude held by many people on our campus. To make this happen, I would have to lead these potentially emotionally charged discussions, and I would need support. If not me, then who? If not now, then when? My strategy was to be intentional about building enough trust and connection to talk about equity issues and to commit to helping those who are normally silenced acquire the skills and grounded confidence to participate in these tough conversations. I invested in building high-performing connected teams by using strengths-based and work personality assessments, and I developed structured protocols for hard conversations, including progress checks. I'm committed to tackling problems that threaten our mission, vision, and values, and I challenge others to call out the culture killers in our organization. We celebrate what works, and we change the things that don't add value to the organization. I changed the narrative of our school by growing power with people through distributive and collective leadership, and by empowering others to lead, ultimately being true to who I am as a person, respecting my journey, and owning my story. Gave me the opportunity to lead in a deeper, more meaningful way. More Rumble tools. Just a reminder that you can find more resources for rumbling with vulnerability on the Dare to Lead Hub on BrenéBrown.com. You'll find a downloadable workbook, a glossary, and images, as well as role play videos that you can watch as part of building your own Rumble skills. And whether or not you choose to download the workbook or watch the videos, never underestimate the value of role-playing, practicing, and writing down notes and bringing them with you into important meetings or conversations. I do all three every day. I once worked for a boss who said, "Are you referring to notes?" when he saw me looking at my journal during a very tough resignation conversation. I said, "Yes, I've given this conversation a lot of thought. It's important to me, and I want to make sure I share all of what I've prepared with you." He shifted in his chair as I prepared to defend my notes. He said, "That's a really cool idea. Do you just use bullet points or do you write whole paragraphs?" People, people, people are just people, people, people. Part 2. Living into our values. The arena, particularly during dark and hard moments when we're trying to be really brave, can be confusing and overwhelming. Distractions, noise, a rapidly blinking exit sign that promises immediate relief from the discomfort, and the cynics in the stands. In those tough matches when the critics are being extra loud and rowdy, it's easy to start hustling, to try to prove, perfect, perform, and please. God knows these are my four big P's. We can either hustle to show the crowd that we deserve to be there, or we can let them scare us off. Either way, it's easy to let them get in our head and hijack our efforts. In those moments when we start putting other voices in front of our own, we forget what made us go into the arena in the first place, the reason we're there. We forget our values. Or frequently, we don't even know what they are or how to name them. If we don't have clarity of values, if we don't have anywhere else to look or focus, if we don't have that light up above to remind us why we're there, the cynics and critics can bring us to our knees. More often than not, our values are what lead us to the arena door. We're willing to do something uncomfortable and daring because of our beliefs. And when we get in there and stumble or fall, we need our values to remind us why we went in, especially when we're face down, covered in dust and sweat and blood. Here's the thing about values. While courage requires checking our armor and weapons at the door, we don't have to enter every tough conversation and difficult rumble completely empty-handed. The daring leaders we interviewed were never empty-handed in the arena. In addition to rumble skills and tools, they always carried with them clarity of values. This clarity is an essential support, a North Star in times of darkness. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, values are principles or standards of behavior, one's judgment of what is important in life. In our work, I simplify the definition. A value is a way of being or believing that we hold most important. Living into our values means that we do more than profess our values. We practice them. We walk our talk. We are clear about what we believe and hold important. And we take care that our intentions, words, thoughts, and behaviors align with those beliefs. Living into our values requires some upfront work, contemplation that most of us have never taken the time to do. And as much as I don't want to make this part feel like a workbook, it's going to be work in a book. I'll take you through the five steps and share some of my experiences, you know, both good and bad. So if you hang with me, after a few minutes, I bet you'll know more about yourself and how to live into your values than you do right now. Step one, we can't live into values that we can't name. The first step of living into our values is divining what's most important to us. What is our North Star? What values do we hold most sacred? We can't work to stay aligned with values when we haven't spent any time getting curious about or naming what we care about the most. When I facilitate this work in organizations, I always get this question. Do you want me to identify my professional values or my personal values? Here's the rub. We only have one set of values. We don't shift our values based on context. We are called to live in a way that is aligned with what we hold most important, regardless of the setting or situation. This, of course, is the challenge of living into our values. Those moments when our values are in conflict with the values of our organization, our friends, a stranger, in line at the grocery store or polling station, or even our family. We have put together a list of values that we use in our work. Because you're listening to the audio of the book, you can go to brenebrown.com/daretolead and just print out the list of values. The list of values are also in the book if that's an easier way for you to do it, but you don't have to buy the book if you've got the audio because we've got that online for you. Once you print out the list or take a look at it, if you've got the book as well as the audio, you can see there are over 100 different values and there are blank spaces for you to write in values that we may not have included. The task is to pick the two that you hold most important. And since you're listening to the audio, I'm just going to go through some of them with you. I'm not going to read all, there's over 100, but I'm going to go through some of them with you just so you can, you know, if you're in your car driving to work or you're out for a walk, I want you to be able to picture. So it just says list of values at the top, and it's got everything from accountability, achievement, belonging, collaboration, curiosity, equality, loyalty, serenity, respect, teamwork, trust, vulnerability, wholeheartedness, wisdom. The task, again, is to pick out two that you hold most important. And I know this is tough because almost everyone we've ever done the work with, including me, wants to pick somewhere between 10 and 15. So here's how I can soften the blow. Start by circling everything, you know, 15 or 20 that you really are drawn to. But you can't stop the process until you're down to two core values. Here's why. The research participants who demonstrated the most willingness to rumble with vulnerability and practice courage tethered their behavior to one or two values, not 10. This makes sense for a couple of reasons. First, I see it the same way I see Jim Collins' mandate, if you have more than three priorities, you have no priorities. At some point, if everything on this list is important, then nothing is truly a driver for you. It's just a gauzy list of feel-good words. Second, I've taken more than 10,000 people through this work, and when people are willing to stay with the process long enough to whittle their list down to two, they always come to the same conclusion that I did with my own values process. My two core values are where all of those second-tier circled values are tested. Here's how that works in my life. My two central values are faith and courage. I hated not circling family. But as I dug in, I realized that while my family is the most important thing in my life, my commitment to them is fueled by my faith and courage. For example, when I say no to an exciting work opportunity because I don't want to miss driving carpool, I lean into my courage and faith. It may be different for you, but I have to be brave enough to say no and not let the fear that someone might think I'm being ungrateful for turning down an opportunity get the best of me. I also need the strength of my faith to remind me that if I do what's right for me, there will be other opportunities. Sometimes my prayer is simply, if I missed the boat, it wasn't my boat. Our values should be so crystallized in our minds, so infallible, so precise and clear and unassailable, that they don't feel like a choice. They are simply a definition of who we are in our lives. In those hard moments, we know that we're going to pick what's right, right now, over what's easy. Because that's integrity. Choosing courage over comfort. It's choosing what's right over what's fun, fast, or easy. And it's practicing our values, not just professing them. So choose one or two values, the beliefs that are the most important and dear to you, that help you find your way in the dark, that fill you with a sense of purpose. As you look over the list, you should feel a deep resonance of self-identification. Resist holding on to words that resemble something you've been coached to be, words that have never really felt true to you. Ask yourself, does this define me? Is this who I am at my best? Is this a filter that I use to make hard decisions? Then we'll move to step two, taking values from BS to behavior. The reason we roll our eyes when people start talking about values is that everyone talks a big values game, but very few people actually practice one. It can be infuriating, and it's not just individuals who fall short of the talk. In our experience, only about 10% of organizations have operationalized their values into teachable and observable behaviors that are used to train their employees and hold them accountable. 10%. And yes, by the way, I have taken to the occasional izing, at work. So while I was once a critic of adding izing to different words, it comes in handy. If you're not going to take the time to translate values from ideals to behaviors, if you're not going to teach people the skills they need to show up in a way that's aligned with those values and then create a culture in which you hold one another accountable for staying aligned with the values, it's better not to profess any values at all. They become a joke, a cat poster, total BS. In this second step of the living into our values process, we need to define three or four behaviors that support our values and three or four slippery behaviors, actions we find ourselves tempted to do even though they are counter to our values. And we need to get explicit. There's no magic in three or four behaviors. It's just enough to force us to think beyond what's easy and not so many that we're just making a list. The best way to do this is to think through some arena moments when you either did or did not show up in a way that felt aligned with your values. For example, I often find myself in dust-ups on social media around social justice issues. People will leave comments like, stick to the writing, immigration isn't your issue, or stop talking about race so much. These sentiments even show up at my public events during open Q&A sessions. My value of courage calls on me to stand up and speak out for my beliefs. If you say something to me or in front of me that I find racist or sexist or homophobic, even if other people are laughing, I'm not going to laugh. I'm going to ask you to not say that stuff around me. I don't do this out of self-righteousness or being better than. Trust me, there are times when I just rather shoot you a dirty look and walk away. I say something because courage is one of my key values. And for me to feel physically, emotionally, and spiritually okay, courage insists that I honor it by choosing my voice over my comfort. If there's an issue that I feel passionate about, I'm going to write about it and post it on social media. If you leave a shaming comment or you're hateful toward me or anyone in my community, I'm going to delete it and I'm going to ban you from my page. One of my courage behaviors is don't choose silence over what is right. It's not my job to make other people more comfortable or to be liked by everyone. Faith has been so tough for me over the past year because one of my faith behaviors is to find the face of God in everyone. Ugh. That means rather than hating people, I have to hate only their ideas. Rather than shaming and blaming people, I have to hold them accountable. Blame is so easy and accountability is such a time suck and no fun at all. I tried reworking faith to be finding God in the face of people I like and with whom I agree, but that did not last more than a day. I quickly turned into someone I didn't like. I couldn't find God in myself. Another one of my faith behaviors is no dehumanizing language. I've been living into this value for close to 20 years, and now I cringe when I hear anything dehumanizing from either side of the aisle. I cringe a lot, and I have to take regular social media sabbaticals. It's the most difficult when I have to say something to someone who shares my politics and justifies dehumanizing language because, quote, you know, we're the good guys. That doesn't work. We all know what it feels like to walk outside of our values. We all know what it feels like to stay silent and comfortable instead of voicing what we believe. I test my values all the time. I see how far I can push and cajole them before they break. I'm imperfect and scared a lot. I mean, we all are. But think about those moments when something really hard has happened to someone in our lives. Maybe a friend or a colleague has a partner or a parent or a child who's been hurt or killed. And we know that we need to make a call to check in and see how we can support. But rather than doing that, we zigzag. We walk past the phone so many times that we eventually convince ourselves that it's too embarrassingly late to make the call. It starts with, okay, I should call right now. Oh, but they're probably eating dinner. I'll call later. Then several hours go by. You know what? It's bedtime. It's late. I'll just call tomorrow. Then we wake up the next morning. You know what? I bet they still have a lot of family over. I'll call in a few days when it's quieter and things have settled down. And what do we feel when we never make that call? And we run into that colleague or friend 2 or 3 weeks later at the grocery store? Most of us feel shame, and we feel completely outside of our integrity. On my list of courage behaviors is something my mom taught us growing up. Show up for people in pain and don't look away. From my experience and from what I've learned from the daring leaders I've interviewed, I will pick those 5 to 10 seconds of discomfort any day over pulling into my driveway and turning off the car while thinking about what I did or didn't do and how missing the opportunity to do or say something was a betrayal of what I value most. Another courage behavior for me, choose courage over comfort. I'll share a little hack with you about those seconds of discomfort. I did an experiment several years ago to see how long the intense kind of in-the-moment discomfort lasts. After a couple of months of tracking it, I landed on 8 seconds. In most situations, there are 8 seconds of intense discomfort. I told Steve, oh my God, it's like riding a bull. You have to make it 8 seconds. So now, when I know something hard is fixing to happen, I always think of George Strait's Amarillo by Morning, but I'll be looking for 8 when they pull that gate. I mean, come on, we can do anything for 8 seconds, right? The discomfort may linger long after, but the hardest part of the ride has settled down. In addition to the values download, we put some questions and prompts together to help you think operationalizing your values. It's all on the same PDF on BrenéBrown.com. So download it and work through this. It's a big life changer. Step 3, empathy and self-compassion, the 2 most important seats in the arena. One of the greatest challenges during our arena moments is the people in the stands, specifically the hardened season ticket holders who show up whether it's rain, shine, or sleet. The arena is full of seats, but these are the seats we choose to focus on. Shame has 2 of those season tickets. Gremlins always like to travel in pairs so they can squeeze you from both sides, the never good enough side and the who do you think you are side. Scarcity and comparison are also in those seats close by. Scarcity is the voice of, there's never enough time, money, love, attention. And comparison brings, look how other people are doing it so much better than you. The box seats are the privileged seats. They are filled with the people who built the arena. And they built that arena to benefit the people who look just like them in terms of race, class, sexual orientation, ability, and status. These people have already determined your odds based on stereotypes, misinformation, and fear. And we have to acknowledge this and talk about it. Regardless of the values you pick, daring leaders who live into their values are never silent about hard things. There is an incredibly important, uncomfortable, and brave discussion that every single leader and every organization in the world should be having about privilege. The truth is, when I walk into the arena, I don't have the same experience as other people walking into the same arena. I'm white, I'm straight, I'm educated. There are a lot of people in those stands who are expecting me to do well and who are cheering me on. Do I have something to overcome around gender? Absolutely. But there is no doubt that I operate from a place that is far more privileged than others. When we think about the arena, we have to think about factors like race, age, gender, class, sexual orientation, physical ability, cognitive ability, just to name a few. I haven't been in a company in 5 years where people aren't whispering, "This is really great, but how do you talk about race?" My response, you first listen about race. And you will make a lot of mistakes. It will be super uncomfortable. And there's no way to talk about it without getting some criticism. But you can't be silent. To opt out of conversations about privilege and oppression because they make you uncomfortable is the epitome of privilege. Silence is not brave leadership, and silence is not a component of brave cultures. Showing up and being courageous around these difficult conversations is not a path you can predetermine. A brave leader is not someone who's armed with all the answers. A brave leader is not someone who can facilitate a flawless discussion on a hard topic. A brave leader is someone who says, "I see you, I hear you, I don't have all the answers, but I'm going to keep listening and asking questions." We all have the capacity to do that. We all have the ability to foster empathy. If we want to do good work, it's imperative that we continue to flesh out these harder conversations, to push against secrecy, silence, and judgment. It's the only way to eradicate shame from the workplace, to clear the way for a performance in the arena that correlates with our highest values and not the fearmongers from the stands. The most important seats in the arena, the ones we need to be able to focus on, especially in difficult times, are reserved for empathy and self-compassion. In the empathy seat, or seats, we just need one or two people who know our values and support our efforts to put them into action. And the self-compassion seat is for us. It's a reminder that if we can't cheer ourselves on, we shouldn't expect others to do it. If we don't make our values priorities, we can't ask others to do it for us. Some questions to think about. Number one, who is someone who knows your values and supports your efforts to live into them? Number two, what does support from this person actually look like? Number three, what can you do as an act of self-compassion to support yourself in the hard work of living into your values? Number four, what are the early warning indicators or signs that you're living outside of your values? Number five, what does it feel like when you're living into your values? And number six, how does living into your two values shape the way you give and receive feedback? I'm lucky because I feel like I have an empathy section behind my empathy seat. The empathy seat belongs to Steve. Even when he knows that my taking on an issue will bring stress to our house, he will say, "This is what you have to do. It's who you are and why I love you. Now let's batten down the hatches and do this thing." My sisters and even my kids, now that they're older, are often in that empathy hot seat. It's not always easy to support someone who has a public presence. They know that the backlash from speaking up can be cruel and even threatening at times. My work team is also a huge part of my empathy section. I couldn't do the work I do without them. Support looks like love, encouragement, straight talk, boundary setting, and the occasional, "No, I don't actually support this, and here's why." Self-compassion is an easy list to write and a hard list to live. For me, self-compassion is about sleep, healthy food, exercise, and connection. It's what I mentioned in the concussion story. The best predictor of living into my values is being in physical, spiritual, and emotional shape. I know I'm living outside of my values when I am, drumroll, because this is a huge issue for me, resentful. Resentment is my barometer and my early warning system. It's the canary in the coal mine. It shows up when I stay quiet in order not to piss off someone. It shows up when I put work before my well-being, and it blows the doors off the hinges when I'm not setting good boundaries. Faith and courage take a lot of work. You are far enough into this book that you know how much effort and skill it takes to be brave. Faith is the same. My favorite definition of spirituality is from my friend and mentor, Pittman McGeehee. Pittman is a Jungian analyst, Episcopal priest, and author whose work has been a tremendous help to me. Pittman says, "Spirituality is the deep human longing to experience the transcendent in our ordinary life. It's the expectation to experience the extraordinary in the ordinary, the miraculous in the mundane, and the sacred camouflaged in the profane." My faith requires serious daily practice. I do not have time to get caught up in some bullshit beef on Twitter with a stranger. I'm busy trying to find the miraculous in the mundane. When it hits me that I'm squandering precious time, I get resentful and mad at myself. And look, if you're thinking maybe your Twitter fight is the sacred camouflaged in the profane, I will tell you that I'm not there yet. What it feels like when I'm living into my values? And in terms of the question of what it feels like when I'm living into my values, I think how I answer this question has actually changed over the years. I used to believe that we would know that we were in our values when the decisions came easily. But I've learned as a leader that it's actually the opposite. I know I'm in my values when a decision is somewhere between tough and really tough. I wish doing the right thing was the easy thing, but it rarely is. I no longer expect wonderful moments. Instead, I look for quiet moments when I feel strong and solid, and usually really tired. To quote Leonard Cohen, as I often do about tough arena moments, love is not a victory march. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah. Living into our values and feedback. One of the biggest challenges we face, especially at work, is staying aligned with our values when giving and receiving feedback. I put together the Engaged Feedback Checklist for Daring Greatly, which is worth revisiting here. I wrote it based on the research we did for that book, and I'm happy to report that it stands the test of the new leadership data as well. This is a guideline for readiness. Are you in the right headspace to sit down and give someone feedback? Number one, I know I'm ready to give feedback when I'm ready to sit next to you rather than across from you. Often, sitting across from someone is not just about logistics. It reflects that we think about relationships as inherently adversarial. Maybe it's okay to occasionally sit across from someone, but if there's something huge between you, then a massive desk is only going to create more distance. It's also a representation of a power differential. Number two, I know I'm ready to give feedback when I'm willing to put the problem in front of us rather than between us or sliding it toward you. A big lumbering issue between two people is very different than sitting next to someone and putting the issue in front of both of you so that you can look at the problem from the same perspective. Often, this requires a shift in language from "you are wrong here" to "there's something that needs to change." It's a completely different physical, cognitive, emotional, and spiritual experience when someone is on your side and helping you through the hurdle rather than pointing out your participation in the problem. Number three, I know I'm ready to give feedback when I'm ready to listen, ask questions, and accept that I may not fully understand the issue. Often, in the midst of a feedback session, we forget that we're supposed to be facilitating and fact-finding from a place of curiosity, not lecturing. When we lecture, we're typically focused on getting it over with, on shoveling one lesson into one session. We want to get this difficult feedback or hard conversation over with, and we certainly don't want to string it along over multiple sessions. Instead of doing this, we must lean into our grounded confidence. Here's what I'm seeing. Here's what I'm making up about what I see. I have a lot of questions. Can you help me understand? Then dig in. Take notes. Ask questions. Followed up by, I need some time to think about this. Can we circle back tomorrow? I'll come to you if more questions come up, and if you have questions, please come to me. Number four, I know I'm ready to give feedback when I'm ready to acknowledge what you do well instead of just picking apart your mistakes. This can be tricky. Sometimes there's a crisis and sometimes there's a work product or a deliverable that has a tight timeline and it's not coming along according to expectations. In those moments, it doesn't always feel authentic to sit down and say, hey, thanks for your time. Here are the three things you do well. When you're dying to cut to the chase with, hey, this is not right and it's due at 5 o'clock. But the latter doesn't serve. I think back to Ken Blanchard's wisdom and how catching people doing things right is so much more powerful than just angrily listing the mistakes. It takes 2 minutes to say, hey, I know this is due at 5 o'clock and the executive summary looks pitch perfect. The tables need some serious work though. What does support look like? Number five, I know I'm ready to give feedback when I recognize your strengths and how you can use them to address your challenges. I believe a strengths-based feedback style is the best approach, in which you explain some of the strengths or things that they do really well that have not been applied to the current situation. For example, hey, one of your great